بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. صبحكم الله بالخير جميعا. Good morning everybody. Thank you for attending the second session under the title of Towards a Knowledge-Based Economy in the GCC. It's truly a pleasure to be here amongst all these great minds. And I enjoyed yesterday the first session, and I hope you will enjoy also this session with our honorable speakers. We have three speakers this morning. Each speaker will have 15 minutes. We will share a very important issue, and they will also shed the light on what's happening now in the world and what affects the global economy. And hopefully, certainly they will concentrate on the issues on our Gulf economies. It's my pleasure to introduce the first speaker. Allow me just... Dr. Christian. I'll try to pronounce this second name or the last name. Alterson. Okay. Dr. Christian is the Kuwait Research Fellow and Deputy Director of Kuwait Program on Development, Governance, and Globalization at LSE. He has held this position since March 2008, and before that he was a senior analyst at the Gulf Center for Strategic Studies in London. Welcome, Mr. Christian, please.
Thank you very much. This paper arises out of research conducted as part of a collaborative research project into the knowledge economy in Kuwait, led by the Work Foundation in collaboration with KFAS and supported by KFAS. And I would like to first of all pay a tribute to the professionalism of the local team of experts in Kuwait who helped with the research and provided invaluable feedback at every stage. As the Minister very rightly said, this is an extremely important issue which is being taken with increasing seriousness throughout the Gulf, particularly so here in Kuwait. Like its counterparts, policymakers have in recent years embraced the concept of knowledge economy as integral to their ambitious programs of economic diversification. Underlying the moves towards this transition is an acknowledgement of the necessity of producing well-educated and qualified workforce able to compete in internationally competitive labor markets and alleviate problems of unemployment. Some of the results have been eye-catching as hubs of agglomeration for knowledge-intensive goods and services, creating a real added value, have complemented these strategies of economic diversification underway throughout this region. These in turn represent a crucial element of their adaptation to the broader processes of structural change to the global economy based on accelerating flows of information, knowledge, capital, and humans across national boundaries. This presentation starts with a definitional overview of knowledge economies, moving down to the focus on the Gulf states themselves, contextualizing them within the plans of diversification and the national visions, which have added successful instances of the knowledge economy in practice throughout parts of the region, and then describing how an enabling environment must be constructed if knowledge economies are to achieve a takeoff and spread beyond the present existing enclaves of expertise. So transitioning toward a knowledge economy involves a shift from a reliance on physical capital and low-cost labor for competitive advantage toward the rise of technology and knowledge-based industries as major generators of value-added exports and new jobs. Although definitions vary across organizations and institutions, the underlying tenets are well captured by the Economic and Social Research Council in the United Kingdom, which defines the knowledge economy as an emerging economic structure in which economic success is increasingly based on the effective utilization of intangible assets, knowledge, such as knowledge, skills, and innovative potential, as the key resource for competitive advantage. This approach emphasizes how the knowledge economy affects every sector within an economy, whether in knowledge intensive or not, and that it's a process of continuous adaptation rather than a one-off acquisition or step. Embedded in this process of change is the emergence and expansion of a highly educated workforce, reflecting the fact that education and the production of and access to knowledge are the great dividers in a modern information-based society. They encompass a range of tangible and intangible factors feeding into cumulative policy reforms to create an enabling environment and institutional infrastructure within which this transition can take shape. As countries around the world, from global first movers such as South Korea or Singapore, which is frequently cited as a model here in the Gulf, and the Scandinavian states, to regional latecomers as well, as they develop explicit knowledge economy strategies, the opportunity cost from failing to do so becomes greater. This is particularly the case here in the Gulf and comparatively high income developing countries, where the scale and intensity of investment in the knowledge economy has really accelerated since the beginning of this century. National approaches toward building knowledge economies thus vary, as do the exact definitions of what is precisely encompassed. There's an innovation index of factors deemed necessary for knowledge creation and an entrepreneurship of labour, including a skilled labour force, greater openness to new ideas, higher education in public research and collaboration with industry, and a culture of entrepreneurship within a competitive and demand-led business environment that rewards and encourages innovation. Research led by Will Hutton, who I'm standing in for, and the Work Foundation have also emphasized the importance of investment in knowledge-based intangibles in contributing to successful transitions. Therefore, it requires greater and sustained level of engagement on multiple fronts rather than just one or two alone. And to have any chance of success, a complex enabling environment must emerge, interlinking reforms to institutional and capacity-building infrastructure, market development and appropriate legal frameworks, particularly over intellectual property rights, for example, a financial system capable of mobilizing and channeling investment to firms whose innovatory outputs may encompass a lengthy startup phase, underpinned by the intangible values inherent in nurturing a meritocratic business culture of productive entrepreneurship. Moving to the GCC, their higher levels of GDP and income per citizen means they're better equipped than other countries in the Middle East and North Africa, as we've seen, to begin the transition toward a knowledge-based economy. And that's evident in the national visions and plans adopted in each country. Here in Kuwait, Vision 2030 and the four-year development plan have both called for a thorough, deep and radical set of reforms to undertake the structural changes in any deep economic transition. But elsewhere, Oman was the first country in the Gulf to formulate a real economic diversification strategy with the launch of Oman 2020 in June 1996, a comprehensive approach designed to run in conjunction with an ongoing series of five-year development plans, focusing directly on economic diversification and expanding the private and non-oil sectors. Bahrain, like Oman, which faces a depletion of hydrocarbon reserves much sooner than the other countries in the Gulf, also introduced a package of measures in the early 2000s, including labour market reform, economic reform and educational and training reform, spearheaded by the newly created Economic Development Board, promoting a pro-business agenda based around the branding of business-friendly Bahrain, which may or may not survive the recent developments. These early movers in diversification have been surpassed in order of magnitude by more recent ones in Qatar, the UAE and Saudi Arabia. In 2008, the General Secretariat for Development Planning in Qatar unveiled its ambitious Qatar National Vision 2030, outlining five major challenges, including meeting the needs both of current and future generations, and aligning economic growth with social development and environmental management. Its emphasis on human and sustainable development is evident in the rapid expansion of Ras Laffan Industrial City, which has emerged as one of the fastest-growing industrial cities in the world, and an integrated hub in the production and export of liquefied natural gas and gas to liquids. An important related development in Qatar, which again sets it ahead of the curve, is the creation of the Qatar National Research Fund, dedicated to identifying and funding research to directly meet the needs of Qatar as set out in its national diversification strategy, therefore interlinking the two processes of economic diversification and the knowledge economic transition. Abu Dhabi has to a degree, or the UAE, has to a degree emulated the Qatari approach by prioritizing strategic research vision with a combination of high technology, heavy industry, and future energy industries within the framework of its own Economic Vision 2030. The establishment of the Abu Dhabi Future Energy Company and its ambitious plans to develop Masdar City is largely intended to create the infrastructural basis for an enormous free zone concentration of renewable energy company and research. In addition to facilitating joint ventures with major international partners and stimulating investment flows of foreign direct investment, the initiative would also position Abu Dhabi as a global leader in the field of renewable or sustainable energy research. In Saudi Arabia, the creation of economic cities as hubs of agglomeration and diversification form a major element in its own strategies. A series of initiatives have been launched, including the construction of the showpiece King Abdullah Economic City on the Red Sea coast, containing an integrated seaport, industrial centre and financial sector. Building on the Kingdom's long-delayed accession to the WTO in 2005 and the privatisation of key economic sectors in order to attract foreign investment. More importantly, the cities are designed to bypass sometimes cumbersome bureaucratic structures by creating parallel economies based on regulatory frameworks conducive to private investment. Together with the large-scale petrochemical projects underway at Ras Tanura, Jubail Industrial City, and the Petro Rabigh Refinery, these initiatives are expected to create up to 10 million new jobs in the kingdom. And their programs have already developed into emergent examples of knowledge-intensive hubs, creating a web of linkages tying them into networks of sophisticated value added and value creation. The most successful of these localized instances of knowledge economy at work is SABIC, the Saudi Basic Industries Corporation, employing high-quality local personnel and has established its own research centres and petrochemical affiliates that increasingly design the products it goes on to sell across the globe. A clear example of these direct backward linkages at work is the construction of a massive acetone plant in Jubail Industrial City by the Saudi Kayan Petrochemical Company, an affiliate of SABIC. Another example of these emerging backward linkages is here in Kuwait, the agreement between the Kuwait Petroleum Corporation and Kuwait Institute for Scientific Research, KISR, to establish a petroleum research council and to jointly implement a number of trial applications of solar energy technologies. So my final section, I'll just have an overview of the prospects for knowledge economies in the GCC, as I know this is what the other two speakers will pick up on as well, and to say that the knowledge economy is therefore this key component of economic transformation and should be viewed as an ongoing process of structural and intangible change rather than an acquisition-based or measurable end in itself. Creating an enabling environment for this to occur is a similarly long-term process. At least in its initial stages, a top-down state approach can play an important role in generating the momentum for change and the buy-in from key stakeholders across the state and business community. This was the case in the successful transitions underway in the East Asian economies, South Korea, Singapore, Malaysia, and Taiwan. In these countries, plans were drawn up and implemented in relatively short periods of time with substantial public investments and based on the identification of national characteristics and features around which success and expertise could be built. These specificities differ from country to country, but in each case, the existence of relatively strong institutional contexts, private sectors and public corporations proved critical common features in the building blocks for reform. Distinctive pathways to knowledge economy transitions therefore reflect the wide variation in factors and variables between states. But we can identify certain commonalities as important. The first is the existence of the appropriate domestic institutional framework, capable both of supporting innovatory projects and coordinating initiatives in a whole-of-government approach to reform. Organizations such as the Council for Economic Planning and Development in Taiwan, the Economic Development Board in Singapore, or the Research and Innovation Council in Finland have all functioned elsewhere as lead agencies providing strategic direction in close cooperation with policymakers and politicians. Institutional and regulatory reforms have indeed reshaped the business environment in the Gulf over the last 10 years and also need to be integrated with reforms to educational systems and labour markets to be successful. The key to the successful transition ultimately will be moving from the building of physical capital to the building of human capital, whereby people are incentivized and equipped to become competitive on a global level thereby shifting a country's comparative advantage, in this case through the possession of oil and gas, into a competitive advantage based on its local workforce and population. Policymakers and analysts should therefore adopt a realistic understanding of how long the transition might take and target their commitments accordingly. Again, in East Asia, we've seen the shift began in the overhauling of economic structures in the early 1960s and only really reached fruition in the 1980s and beyond. So institutional development and strengthening, changing notions of educational attainment and the value of ascribed to the acquisition of knowledge will all be cross-generational as families with higher levels of education will become role models for succeeding generations. Thus, while the Gulf states have indeed made significant progress in creating enclaves of concentrated expertise in which research and development and university-industry collaboration can take root and flourish, embedding and expanding their share in the economy will be central to the task of moving from a political economy based on the hydrocarbons to one on a competitive, knowledge-intensive one capable of competing in a rapidly globalizing environment. The challenge in coming years and decades will indeed be to steadily widen the reach of the knowledge economy and to mainstream it within sectors and professions hitherto little touched by the process of change, while moving down from a top-down investment in physical capital to this more autonomous development of the human base. Improvements to standards of education and higher education will have to be aligned with the current and future needs of labour markets. Legacies of market distorting or unproductive rent-seeking patterns of behaviour will need to be eventually marginalised. And any such change would be transformational in its impact on state-society relations and inevitably on mechanisms of political participation in decision-making processes. It may appear, particularly in this moment of change in the Gulf and in the wider region, counterintuitive for regimes or governments to promote policies that could facilitate the growth of a more engaged element within their own polity, but a sustained and transformative process of reform will be much more likely to succeed if it's measured and consensual and undertaken in a spirit of partnership between state and society. It would also fit in with efforts to promote knowledge-based economic transitions and to fit in with the Gulf states' pragmatic transitions to very different periods of rule in of conditions in their histories. Therefore, the survey I've tried to present here has pinpointed the current state of affairs as one step in a journey rather than an end fixed point. The transition to is a long-term initiative. An interim assessment would be that progress has undoubtedly been made in areas such as enclave developments or attracting institutes of higher education to the region, as we saw yesterday. But I'd caution that many of the enabling conditions still await much more work, and this would be a long-term initiative. The challenge of policymakers is to link these initial achievements to wider reforms and to strengthen the enabling conditions to spread the transition downwards and horizontally across the economic spectrum. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Christian, who was kind enough to present the paper of Will Hatton, who was unable to be with us today. I thank you for this presentation, and you try to, you know, start the first step in the transformation of our economy toward the knowledge-based economy. Now it's my pleasure to present the second speaker, Dr. Christopher Davidson. Dr. Christopher is a reader in a Middle East political at Durham University in United Kingdom. Before joining Durham, he was assistant professor at Zayed University in United Arab Emirates. It's a pleasure, Dr.
Many Christian. Thanks, Your Excellency. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Very pleased to be back in Kuwait. I think it's 2 years since I was last here. I was just slightly disappointed to miss the 50-year celebrations and presumably see all the skyscrapers beautifully lit up for the occasion.
Still some of the...
Some, I saw a few. But I'd really wanted to see all of them. Knowledge economy in the Gulf. I have to confess, until recently, I was never quite sure what knowledge economy meant. Perhaps now I'm still not 100% clear either, so I feel a little bit of an imposter. I remember a few years back, I think it was summer 2007, I was drafted in by a British consultancy company to help set up a ministry-like government authority that I'm sure Kenneth is very well aware of in the Emirate of Dubai, which was supposed to be responsible for knowledge and human development. It was called the Knowledge and Human Development Authority. I was working for a UK-based company that I better not name, but let's put it this way, it was famous at the time for having lost a memory stick containing all of the British Home Office's list of prisoners, their families, their addresses, etc. So it's a bit about my professional background for you. I remember arriving in this building, which had just been constructed in the middle of the desert, it seemed at the time. When we had our first meeting, we had to actually pull off the cling film wrapping off all the chairs before we could even begin actually working there. We were sitting around looking at this document that had just been produced called the Dubai Strategic Plan 2015, which had been produced by another foreign consultancy company. And it was peppered with knowledge economy this, knowledge economy that. And I remember we were all sitting around trying to work out what does this actually mean. We probably needed Christian in the room with us to help give us some kind of overview. Well, a few things quickly became apparent to me when this authority was being set up. It seemed to me that knowledge, certainly knowledge economy, was seen as being part of Dubai's efforts to diversify its post-oil economy, rather than knowledge itself being an actual life skill, a privilege, a right, or anything like that. Of course, the context of the time in 2007, 2008, Dubai was still very much booming, trying to reduce its reliance on oil and gas exports to a minimum, tourism, real estate, etc. And knowledge, research, development, this kind of thing was seen as yet another post-oil sector. In my view, that seemed to be how it's being described in the strategic plan. In many ways, I found this was typified by a development called Knowledge Village, which I'm not sure if any of you have visited, but was essentially one of these free zones in Dubai where foreign companies, in this case universities, could come and set up camp in the Emirate without requiring a local partner, having 100% repatriation of the profits, and not needing, unless they wanted to employ any of the local workforce. So essentially, Dubai was opening up the gates to foreign universities from all over the world. Most of them are coming from Britain, America, Australia, Canada, to come and set up a branch campus. To me, it seemed this was very much, well, I suppose, part of Dubai's efforts to create different kinds of tourism, to bring educational tourists to the Emirate, to come there for 1 year for a master's degree, or to try and offer educational opportunities to the substantial, large, professional, young expatriate population in the Emirate who wanted to study. It seemed to be a profit-making enterprise, rather than actually contributing to national interests or the needs of the local population, their education, and how they'd best fit into the workplace. We had other examples in Dubai at the time, other of these knowledge-related free zones being set up, notably Dubai Internet City, which was supposed to attract foreign companies specializing in high-tech, internet-related products and things like that. After a few years, it became apparent this was not really having much of an impact on the local population. I think right now there are still only 1% of the workforce in Dubai Internet City, if that, are actually made up of the local population. 99%, if not more, are expatriates. I think for the rest of the Gulf states, my experience is more limited, but it seems to me that knowledge and the knowledge economy is not solely treated as part of economic diversification, thankfully, but is perhaps also part of labour nationalisation needs. Of course, in many of the Gulf states, there are substantial expatriate populations that keep going up and up every year as a proportion of the overall population. This is very worrying to the local population, I think also to the leadership too. I think we have a situation looming in certain parts of the Gulf where unless something is done very soon, we will have the local population becoming bystanders, watching the development of their country from the sidelines. And that will lead to a scenario in a few years, if it's not already, where the national population are not becoming guardians, are no longer guardians of their country's future development path. That, to me, seems very sad, having lived in the Gulf for half my life, nearly. We've had some good signs of some of the Gulf states recognizing this need, trying to use education and knowledge to do something about changing this. For example, in Qatar, we've seen universities which have been set up recently in Qatar and Saudi Arabia, where the bulk, or at least substantial quota, of the students have to be made up from the national population. Hopefully this will lead to a cohort of graduates in the near future, which are better able to integrate into the needs of the national economy. All of these developments, of course, many of the new knowledge developments are still relying, in many cases, on foreign assistance, often coming from the West, again, Britain, America, Canada, etc. This, on the surface, doesn't seem particularly good, particularly natural or healthy thing, given that many of these universities, advisors, consultants are perhaps not completely au fait with the needs of the country they're working in or the anthropological realities of living and working in the Gulf states. Nonetheless, I suppose they can help serve as a building block on the road to somewhere better. Second part of my presentation, I'd like to talk a bit about the challenging environment knowledge economy and knowledge economy agents have to work in the Gulf states. So these are some problems I've come up with. I should stress these are just my humble observations, often based on personal experience. My colleague from Durham University, Anoush Eshtahami, yesterday gave us 5 points as food for thought to think of. I'll break his record and go for 6. First and biggest point, which connects very closely to the title of my presentation, Rentier States, I think is the biggest block or challenge to building successful knowledge economy in the Gulf. This is the continuation of rent-based economies in the Gulf states and the political systems that they help to support. Essentially, Kuwait to a lesser extent, of course, but the rest of the Gulf states are still very much traditional monarchies which rely on distribution of wealth in the form of subsidies and various other measures to, in many cases, without generalizing too much, ensure some degree of political acquiescence. I think that's the politest way I can, most sensitive way I can put it. This, of course, means that wealth is coming directly to the government from oil and gas, various other economic activities, which doesn't involve the national population really in the wealth creation process. So you have this wealth going directly to the government, not via taxes from the population, which the government can then distribute to its people in return for some degree of political acquiescence. This makes it difficult to inspire the population, makes it difficult to make your national population be motivated to seek qualifications, to seek jobs, and then once they've got the qualifications, even if they're from a prestigious foreign university in the Gulf, then what do they do with these qualifications? Are they actually going to be willing to enter a highly competitive job market and face off against very well-qualified expatriates, many of whom will be willing to work for quite a bit less without strict conditions and benefits attached to their job opportunity? So lack of motivation, very much connected to this rent-based economy and the political system above it. We also have, as well, connected to this, not just the distribution of wealth to the population, but in the past at least, the distribution of public sector employment. I know that's been the case to a great extent in Kuwait, certainly in the United Arab Emirates too, although it's getting much better. If there's a feeling that there's guaranteed employment at the end of the degree or the college diploma, then again, we're stripped of motivation to really compete. I remember my students in the UAE, the more entrepreneurial ones, they were all Emirati. I used to ask them, okay, you want to set up a business in the private sector when you graduate, who will you employ? And they said, oh, we will employ people from India, Egypt, etc. I said, but what about your brothers and sisters? They said, no, we wouldn't employ our brothers or sisters. And I always used to ask them, do you mind telling me why? And they said, well, they'll ask for more money. They'll want to work until 3 o'clock maximum and want to go home after it, and they'll have to have manager-level position minimum. So this was back in 2003, 2004. I think things have changed a bit, but it's still very much an uphill struggle. I remember in a speech a couple of years ago, the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, shortly after succeeding to become Crown Prince, very much trying to build up all these new sectors in Abu Dhabi's economy, he made a statement that it would be the national duty of the national population to actually take part in the private sector to help build the country. But what seemed to be missing there was an understanding of how this connects to the prevailing political system, where the distribution of wealth and opportunities is used to stave off meaningful political reform. I think also connected to this rent-based economy, still on this same big point, don't worry, the other five are very quick ones, is also getting the national population involved in knowledge economy and education as educators themselves and researchers themselves. If you've had years of public sector employment and prestigious positions in the army, police force, ministries, etc., it's very difficult to recruit people into rank-and-file teaching positions, especially in primary and high schools, even in universities too, to some extent, in some parts of the Gulf states. I remember as part of this job in 2007, we were trying to work out how many male school teachers there were in the Dubai school system, and there were only four at the time in the entire Emirate. So very difficult to actually recruit people. Even offering higher salaries, we realized, wasn't enough because the profession itself was regarded as too low status for the national population. I remember us brainstorming at the time, trying to think of ways to actually inspire young men to go into teaching rather than working in elsewhere in the public sector or family businesses and things. And the only thing that we could really come up with was some kind of medal-based honor system where the ruler would shake their hand, a photo opportunity, and there'd be some kind of national honor or merit conferred on them, because simply bumping up the salary was deemed not enough. Second point I'd like to raise is one of the difficulties the rather poor primary and secondary education system in some parts of the Gulf. We had an excellent overview of the tertiary education section yesterday from John Willoughby, but of course the tertiary education sector in the Gulf very much relies on English language and Western norms in education. Many parts of the Gulf, the students have come from public sector primary and secondary schools. They have not necessarily had English as the first language, but yet, hey presto, they turn age 18. They're expecting to be admitted to these often prestigious universities teaching in English with Western study skills, etc., and they haven't experienced anything like that before. And many of the teachers working in these universities will admit that at least a year is lost at the beginning of the degree, bringing the English up to scratch, bringing the study skills and study habits up to scratch. So there's this enormous shift from Arabic to English having to be made at age 18 for many of the students. Third problem I'd like to mention, which is hopefully getting much better, is the gender issue in education and the knowledge economy. Most of my experiences do date back a few years on this one, but I always remember that women were being educated to degree standard in the United Arab Emirates, but then very often when they were trying to enter the private sector, even if they wanted to, they were being faced with expatriate employers who would tell them, well, you want to work with us, you're not allowed to cover your hair in the workplace. So the girls themselves or maybe their family would then balk at that and the girl couldn't get employed. There were opportunities and there are many opportunities being created from girls from more conservative families, but it still remains an issue. Also, I think there's the issue of postgraduate education for many females in the Gulf states. They may have first-class degrees as an undergrad from the university they've attended in the Gulf, but let's say they want to study abroad, want to do a master's in Britain or America, or even a PhD. In some cases, their family will not allow them, even if they secured the postgraduate scholarship from the government. This, I think, is getting much better, but at least up until a few years ago, it was still an issue for some female students, which is very sad in some cases. The fourth point I'd like to raise is this problem of constrained civil society in some parts of the Gulf. You're bringing in prestigious foreign universities that are used to operating in a free speech environment. They're often promised this. They turn up in the Gulf states and then suddenly find that the internet that the staff and the students are using is not entirely free. There's a censorship system in place. certain issues cannot be discussed in the classroom. I won't go into this too much, but in some cases it's difficult to discuss international history because there are certain points that can't be made or debated with students. This, of course, varies in different parts of the Gulf, what can and can't be talked about. Another point, I think, is the perils of knowledge economy in the Gulf, of foreign research institutes and foreign universities coming and setting up camp, which are very much, in some cases, prestige projects, rather than connected to the needs of the local economy. In some cases, these are, in my view, tools of foreign policy of that government rather than actually what the country or its students or its knowledge economy needs or desires. They're often ways of building up relations with another more powerful country. So in this sense, part of the foreign policy rather than connected to national interests. I won't mention too many names of institutions, but we have universities in the Gulf offering French language education with very little demand for French language education. We have universities coming and setting up camp in the Gulf from America, which are offering classes and subjects that appear to have no relevance to what the national population want or need. Sixth and final point on these problems or pathologies I'll mention are the issues of regional relations too. Universities and research institutes operating in the Gulf have to, of course, be wary of Israel boycotts, issues with employing Iranian staff, Iranian scholars, Iranian students. Can student visas be issued to people from these countries? If not, then why not? And how can the university justify that? In conclusion, I don't want to sound too bearish. After all, the six points I mentioned can all be worked on. The Gulf states have a lot of great opportunities ahead of them when it comes to education and knowledge development. They certainly have the ability to allocate resources from the GDP, not just to guns and tanks, but also hopefully to education more and more in the future. A couple of fears that still remain. I'm yet to be convinced in some parts of the region that education and knowledge is still not connected to economic, it's not purely connected to economic goals. I still see that cropping up again and again. I'm still worried by the lack of emphasis on Arabic at the tertiary sector. It seems to disappear in some parts of the region. I find this quite sad on many levels. Also, the lack, in many cases, of teaching related to the region itself, lack of local history being taught, local politics, local economics classes that are relevant to the issues in the countries. I know, speaking to colleagues here who work at American University of Kuwait, I was very pleased to hear there's an actual Gulf Studies program being set up, and I know there are a few in other parts of the Gulf, but that's really taken a long, long time. You still have new universities in the Gulf today, which seem to have flagship programs based on church and state in America being taught to the students, and I'm not quite sure how that really connects to the reality of their employment when they go home at the end of the day. Perhaps also my other fear is that the Gulf states have a window of opportunity here to establish themselves as a knowledge economy hub for the region with a great tertiary sector education system. This window of opportunity may run out as circumstances change elsewhere in the region, particularly in the high population Arab countries like Egypt, Syria, which have had very well-established universities, but in recent years have struggled due to the unrest and political and economic conditions in those countries. The revolutionary activity we've seen spread across Egypt and North Africa could lead to a reawakening in Egypt, which, of course, has some of the oldest universities in the Arab world. They could really try to very quickly reclaim their position as the center of the Arab world's knowledge economy, and as such, many of the developments in the Gulf could be very much playing second fiddle to that in the future. Very lastly, if I've just got 1 minute left, what can the role of Western and UK institutions such as LSE, Durham, etc. play in the knowledge economy in the Gulf states? I think this is a very careful role. I think in recent years we've seen a lot of mercenary activity being conducted by Western universities and research institutes in the Gulf, where people are just in it for the money, very short-term contracts, and then leave with the national population in the Gulf not being much better for it afterwards. We've had many sort of moon-based institutes and universities being set up, which exist in a little bubble, which have no connection to the street outside. Finally, though, what I think Western institutions can do as they continue to set themselves up in the Gulf is really push much harder for education and knowledge to be seen as building blocks of civil society in the Gulf, not just as building blocks of national economic objectives. So they can really push to be blueprints of some kind of new civil society where censorship of media and internet is no longer tolerated. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Devenson. Thank you for reminding us of the challenges that we are facing in our education system. You know, I try to escape sometime, but you remind me about it.
You're welcome.
Definitely. Too many efforts required to address these challenges in order to go forward in shaping our education system and our economy. Allow me now to introduce our third speaker, Dr. Kenneth Wilson. Dr. Kenneth Wilson is a director of a newly created National Research Foundation of UAE. He's a professor of economics and the director of Economic and Policy Research Unit before in Zayed University. Originally, Dr. Wilson from Australia, he has undertaken research in a wide range of applied economic areas. Welcome, Dr.
Many thanks for those kind words of introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here, and it's always a great pleasure to follow Christopher, because any courageous comments that I might make pale into insignificance, so I feel more courageous about what I might say.
He paved the way for me.
I've got a couple of solutions to six of your problems, and I'm going to trump your six and come up with 10 of my own challenges at the end.
Come on, made my day.
Let's move on. So it's always a safe place to begin by making generalizations, and I feel like a real expert. I came to the UAE 7 years ago for a three-year experiment, and I'm still here after 7 years. I'm never sure whether that's because I failed the initial experiment or I got offered new opportunities. But what I'm going to do is just make a few generalizations, and in my presentation I'm going to focus on some benchmark indicators, if you like, of the current status of the knowledge economy in each of the Gulf states, and then focus in particular upon innovation and the importance of development of innovation systems for taking the knowledge economy fundamentals forward to the next level. And one of the critical aspects of the knowledge economy and the innovation system is the amount of research and development that occurs in each of the Gulf states, and of course that's linked to the amount of expenditure on research and development. So if we look at each of the Gulf states, we don't know for a fact exactly how much they spend on R&D. It's certainly less than 0.5% of GDP. I know that in the UAE it's 0.1% of GDP, and that's one of the better performers in the Gulf, if you like. So the figures are very low by international standards, and I'll come back to that. Historically, there's been relatively little research undertaken in the universities in the Gulf states. The focus has been on undergraduate teaching. That's now shifting and changing as we start to see some postgraduate training and the growth of PhD programs. But in the UAE, for example, the very first PhD programs were only introduced last year, and there are now only two universities offering PhD programs. And yet PhD programs are critical, particularly in science, technology, engineering, maths, for building up the cadre of researchers that are needed for the knowledge-based society and economy and for the innovation system. But things are changing dramatically, and so to some extent the benchmark indicators I introduce are a bit like a historical perspective of a year or two ago, because things are fast moving and we'll see these indicators change. But nevertheless, I'll start with a graph that's impossible to read, so it's a good place to begin. This is the expenditure on R&D for all the OECD countries, and the average for the OECD is 2.26% of GDP. And so you see how far behind the Gulf states are in terms of the wealthy countries of the world that are knowledge-based societies and economies. Now, if we want to actually benchmark where the Gulf states are right now, we face a challenge. You know, how do we actually measure the knowledge economy? Fortunately, there are several different methodologies out there, and the one that's possibly the best in terms of its methodological soundness is the knowledge economy methodology of the World Bank Institute. And they identify four pillars that underpin a knowledge-based society or economy. And so from these four pillars, we develop a composite indicator. Now, the weakness of composite indicators is they're a single figure, which conceals a lot of complexity. But if you disentangle each of the components, you get a fairly accurate picture of the drivers of the knowledge society or the knowledge economy. So we have the four key pillars in the World Bank methodology: the economic and institutional regime, education and skills, the ICT infrastructure, and the innovation system. Now, in my presentation, I want to focus in particular on the innovation system, because that's really where the action needs to be in the short to medium term. Yes, there's a lot going on over there in terms of education and skills. Yes, there is a need for some work over there in the economic and institutional regime, particularly with respect to property rights, intellectual property law, etc. But the ICT infrastructure tends to be quite good amongst the Gulf states. So here's a table that's very difficult to read, which makes it a great one to use for a discussion like this. But you can have these slides later on, so that's fine. If we look over in the left-hand column, we see the individual Gulf country rankings of 146 countries from the World Bank methodology. So we see the stars in the Gulf in terms of the Knowledge Economy Index. Qatar and the UAE ranked 44th and 45th, respectively. Then we have Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, and Saudi. So these figures, if you like, indicate that the Gulf states are punching below their weight in terms of their per capita GDP. So there's a disconnect between where they are in terms of at least one benchmarking methodology vis-a-vis where they could be given their wealth and their wealth positions. If we leave aside one of those pillars, which is the economic and institutional regime, we can construct a composite indicator of the other three, which is the knowledge index, and you see that they're highly correlated anyway. But if we shift across, we see that there's quite a degree of variation between each of the Gulf states around some of these indicators. And the one that I want to focus on in my presentation briefly is the fourth pillar, the innovation pillar. Because innovation is the critical element, if you like, for the greatest opportunities for improving the overall composite indicator. And if we look at the top 10 countries in the Knowledge Economy Index rankings and have a look at some key components of what are the drivers, if you like, why they are the top 10, we see that there are two things that they possess. One is that, on average, they do spend a lot of their GDP on R&D. Now, you can't just say every country should spend the OECD average or some other figure, and Qatar has announced that it aims to spend 2.8% of its GDP on R&D. Resource-rich countries don't need to spend as much. Okay, Australia, which is the 11th ranked country there, it comes in at 1.76%, Norway similar. They're resource-rich countries that have diversified their economies away from a resource base, their knowledge-based economies and societies, but they still spend a substantial amount of their GDP on R&D, but they do it in strategic ways. The other thing, if we look down the right-hand column there, we see that each of these countries possesses major funding agencies that allocate billions of dollars on a competitive basis to the researchers in the universities. And this follows a mixed methodology. Sometimes they use top-down, where they identify specific questions, problems, issues, challenges, topics, where the funding should go. Other times they allow for the best ideas to come up from the universities in individual competitive rounds. So what are we talking about when we talk about innovation and the development of innovation systems. Well, innovation is just simply the conversion of knowledge and ideas into some sort of a benefit. That benefit may be commercial, measurable, but it also might be intangible or social. It might be an improvement, if you like, in the delivery of a service in the public sector, which is more difficult to measure sometimes. I like this definition from Terry Cutler, where he says that basically innovation is creating value by doing things differently or doing something in a novel way. And I use as a simple example the Post-it note, because here were two technologies that have been around for more than 1,000 years, glue and paper. And then somebody had the bright idea that we should combine them together and come up with a Post-it note, which dramatically changed all of our lives because most of us use a Post-it note on a regular basis. So in Cutler's model of the innovation system, there are essentially three component parts: knowledge production, knowledge application, knowledge diffusion. And you really must have these ingredients in some shape or form if you wish to be a knowledge-based society or economy. And so what this looks like, if you like, in terms of a simple visual aid, is a virtuous cycle where you have knowledge production, which occurs in the universities, the research centres, the think tanks, the institutes, etc. The application of the ideas that are generated from the knowledge production process, and the ones that survive a series of tests, if you like, become diffused throughout the economy. And that might be the local economy, but the global economy. So the Post-it note is a simple example. Now, we often get hung up on some of the high-tech innovations and inventions that have changed our lives, like the technology we're using here and now. But some of the innovations can be very simple but have a profound impact. So if we think about this innovation and innovation process, the best way to think about it in terms of how it can contribute to a knowledge-based society or economy is to think of it in terms of a system, okay, that it's like a biological system or it's some sort of a system that once you put these ingredients together evolves in some sort of organic way. And every system is different. So here's a nice picture that my colleague Owen O'Sullivan gave me to have a look at, and so I borrowed it from him, but it's from the OECD, and it identifies the complexity in a typical innovation system. So if we look at the innovation system in Germany or the UK or the US or any country in the world, they're all different. Okay, they're all very, very different based on the nature of their economies and their societies, but they all have common ingredients. They all have this complexity of relationships between the various actors and players in the economy and society that contribute to or help create the innovation system. So if I now have a look at another set of indicators of innovation in each of the Gulf states, there is one other set of indicators from INSEAD, who now produce this thing called the Global Innovation Index, where they go further inside that component of the knowledge economy methodology and try and develop a more, complete picture of the subtleties and complexities that are embedded in that schema that I showed you a moment ago. And so what you can do is identify input contributors to the innovation system and output measures of the products of the innovation system. And this is another picture, if you like, of the complexity that INSEAD has come up with to show you how, you know, you can take this very complex system, but you can disentangle it into some of the drivers. And then if we look at the data for the Gulf states using the INSEAD methodology, we can see that the picture is similar to the picture that was given to us by the World Bank. But here we've got a bit more detail. So, for example, if I jump across to the right-hand side of the table and look at scientific outputs, we can see the ranked position of the Gulf states in INSEAD's 132-country sample. And so we look down the column there and we see Bahrain's 93rd out of 132, Kuwait 37th, Oman 63rd, Qatar 51st, etc. So we see that, in fact, Kuwait is punching above the other Gulf states in terms of its achievements in terms of scientific outputs. And part of that has to do with the role of KFAS and KISA, the fact that Kuwait was the first of the Gulf states to actually invest in a key ingredient of the innovation system. However, it needs to invest a lot more, just like all the other Gulf states do. They need to invest a lot more. Now, I'm fast running out of time, but you get the story. I'm going to race through now to the very end and get to my list of the challenges. Okay, my 10, if you like. The first one is a lack of understanding of what the requirements are to build a knowledge-based society and economy in the sense of the complexity that I presented here. And why is this? Because too often governments in the Gulf rely on the consultants that got Christopher involved, who come in with a boilerplate solution of simplicity. They make a presentation that involves 5 bullet points and say, now there you go, there's your solution. Now, the reality is it's much more complex than that. Lack of funding. Okay, and yet this is a resource-rich place. It's just a question of let's shift some resource from some other place and start to invest more heavily in R&D, if you like. There's little understanding, if you like, of the role that R&D plays in building the competitive advantage of the industry sector that you're interested in. And I might just jump ahead to one slide to illustrate the point in terms of Abu Dhabi, and then I'll finish, because I know a little bit more about what's going on in the UAE. There's some reference already been made by Christian to the economic vision document for Abu Dhabi for 2030. What that did was identify 12 sectors that Abu Dhabi wishes to diversify its economy into by 2030. One of them it already has, the energy, oil and gas sector, but virtually the others were clean slates, starting from scratch. So then the Abu Dhabi government commenced making investments during 2008 into those sectors. And by a period of, say, by the end of 2010, they'd already made tens of billions of dollars worth of investment into each of the sectors that I identify in the middle column. Hadn't gone into all of them, but it had strategically chosen a few, most of them, but it started to really invest heavily in certain ones, for example, semiconductors. And I won't go into the detail of that. Now, what's happened is that the Abu Dhabi government has sat down and developed the science, technology, and innovation policy where it's going to invest up to 0.75% of its GDP directly into those 6 sectors over the next 5 years. So we're talking by up to about $3 billion within a 5-year period on an annual basis. And this is, you know, more of the sort of strategic thinking that has to go on in the Gulf now in terms of building the complex science, technology, innovation framework or innovation system to support the competitiveness of the industries where the investments are being made. And I know I've gone over time, and I apologize. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We have 20 minutes for a few remarks from the audience. So please introduce yourself. And
Dr. Salah Al-Mazidi from Kuwait Institute for Scientific Research. First, I'd like to thank the speakers for the knowledgeable, presentations regarding the knowledge management. As I think we are approaching the super individual empowerment age, where the knowledge is sit and housed in the human brains. And I think it's clear, it's mentioned in your lecture presentations, the ways how to pave the road towards the knowledge-based, let's say, society rather than economy, where among those factors we have seen infrastructure, education, innovation, entrepreneurial culture, and et cetera. And lately, I think Dr. Wilson, he mentioned a recipient, to be creative and could transfer the knowledge and create the knowledge and transfer it, you should be also a good recipient, as been mentioned in the national society, national innovation system. My question here is, how could you rate GCC toward to be as a recipient of knowledge? Where do we stand? And the second comment or question is regarding the national innovation system. We are worried, like in Kuwait, you know, as you mentioned, we are rating 37 among others in innovation, but to have an innovation system, maybe it would be rather rigid and you have to follow it, you know, by book, as they say. But I believe that innovation should be like, could imagine a basketball team or a match where the ball could bounce here and there, rather it goes around, you know, a map or a diagram. And thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Salah. We'll have a few remarks and then we will give you some time.
Okay. My name is Abdullah Bishara, an ex-ambassador. I want to ask you, what's the role of the transnational companies in the as instrument of knowledge, innovation, technology? And I think that the Gulf has not really used, utilized, and capitalized on that. Total absence, or they haven't really captured the importance of transnational in the carrying as instrument for knowledge and innovation.
Thank you, Mr. Fauzi, and then I'll go back.
Thank you again for those, I think, excellent remarks. First, on the points, some of the points Davidson made, basically Gulf labor sitting on the sidelines. I just want to recount an experience. I was involved in a study for the telecommunications sector in Kuwait, and the question we asked foreign consultants, of course, go out and take a look at where the jobs are being created, and who's filling them. Because the experience of the mobile companies was they were having a very high proportion of Kuwaitis working for them. So why is it the rest of the sectors that you have smaller telephone companies, the services and everything else, that there weren't Kuwaitis? What was happening? And the key issue there was, and we ran into this again with our experience in Singapore, if a company is set up in Singapore and you want to bring in a foreign labor, you have to pay them the same wage as local labor. So you can't bring in an Indian technician, computer technician or Egyptian, whatever it is, and pay him one-fourth what you're paying a Kuwaiti technician. That doesn't work. So government regulation is critical and government policy is critical if you really want to make sure that you do. What we found in the telecommunications sector, we were not only creating the jobs, we were creating a lot of jobs, but the jobs were not going to Kuwaitis because of the way the government structures its policy. The other thing I want to comment also is on Dr. Wilson's, on the issue of innovation. Both, I think, Dr. Adnan Shahabuddin and myself were members of National Technology Company. And you would be surprised at the ideas and innovative ideas that not only Kuwaitis have, but that the company itself was able to bring from the outside just in terms of adaptive technologies. You know what the problem was? Getting those ideas through the licensing system. So you want to do something in the health sector, companies will come over here, work with the Kuwaitis. It'll take them 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and nothing happens. No license is issued. They pick up the bags and they go somewhere else. Telecommunications, the same thing. So with the linkage that you have with the economy and what the economy is doing and how you open up the economy and make it easy for innovative ideas to get established, make a huge difference. Otherwise, people just pick up the bags and go somewhere else.
Thank you, Fauzi. I'll take a final two remarks.
Okay.
Yes. Gentlemen, my name is, back, and then I'll come back to you.
My name is Martin Witt from Denmark. I'll never complain again about funding for our universities. Now I can see that we are in top of the index. But my point would be, I attended a conference in Abu Dhabi, actually, I think 10 years ago. It dealt with different ways of learning. And it very much pointed out there was an Asian model and there was a British model. And the Asian model was basically top-down. You would screen people. You would sort of give them, you know, teach them English if they had the capabilities to do that. They will appoint them to universities. And this way they built sort of the innovative system and the innovative capacity in Korea and especially in Singapore. That was a very much top-down thing. In the British system, you would give people a free choice. You could read philosophy, you could read mechanical engineering at your own will. I wonder, when we're considering educational systems in the Gulf, should we approach a sort of more top-down approach, or should we go for the free choice British model? Maybe the top-down model would be the best one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I'm Hans Dries from the LSE, and probably have to apologize for my British colleagues now, but I'm asking about how do you situate, for example, the German University in Cairo with the other American ones, the British ones. I'm asking that because I'm asking about the relevance of the decrees, as Chris was saying, because what does someone do with a liberal arts degree here if they don't go to the City of London or Wall Street, you know? And particularly, what sort of knowledge is it that the Gulf wants? Because I'm always a bit skeptical about these innovation indexes where some the UK is ranging very, very high, and then you actually look at what's manufactured, how sturdy is it, what's the engineering, and all of a sudden you have other countries coming out on top, and the UK not particularly doing so well. So what is it that the Gulf wants from out of it? That's what I'm asking here. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I have to stop and to give a few minutes to our speakers to respond, and then I'm sure you have the rest of the day if there are any more and further remarks because of the shortage of time. Please, who will to start first?
Christian. Okay, thank you. Just to pick up on a couple of points that were raised. One was on Ambassador Bashara about the role of transnational companies. I think this links into the issue of offsets and how can Gulf companies, Gulf strategic sovereign wealth funds, for example, how can they contribute to a knowledge economy takeoff and acquisition of sustainable long-term capital, and rather than just making a one-off offset as part of a fulfilling a requirement for a contract, I think we've had instances in the past where that was the case. Companies saw this as an obstacle or just something they had to do to get the contract. I think Abu Dhabi has been quite strategic in linking its sovereign wealth investments to bringing in, for example, renewable or long-term alternative energy companies to the Emirates, and I think that's a model that the other Gulf states could and should follow and consider overhauling the offset system in that respect and linking it much more closely to the very considerable leverage that their sovereign wealth funds have. In terms of the other question about motivating Kuwaiti or other nationals in the Gulf to work in the private sector, I think some of the issues have become clearer over recent weeks when we've seen public sector wage announcements in the Gulf states, public sector pay increases to try and preempt or to quell any potential social or economic discontent. I think this has raised the differential between the public and the private sector. It's kind of raised the imbalance that already exists, and I think this works against the long-term strategic visions of nationalizing labor forces and also private sector empowerment. So I think this is a short-term measure which directly contradicts longer-term ambitions and objectives, maybe have to be renewed or reviewed in the future. The top-down or free choice model for education, I think the nature of much of knowledge economy takeoff at the early stage will be top-down, so this might be something that the Gulf states should look at in terms of trying to get much more science, technology, and engineering courses and less, as Chris said, church and state in North America.
Thanks. The question about, I suppose, foreign workers not being paid less than nationals. I think here it's perhaps not just a regulatory problem for the government, but also a society one too. That the national population, it's not just about salaries and benefits, but about status attached to particular professions. So I'm not sure so much about the case in Kuwait, but certainly in the very high GDP per capita Gulf states, Qatar, Abu Dhabi in particular, certain professions or jobs are seen as beneath nationals, and I think that could take a generation to solve rather than a set of new regulations. I think also there is, of course, a danger for the Gulf states in starting to look at these salary-related regulations in that they might lose their competitive edge in the global economy when it comes to bringing in foreign companies. I mean, if we're honest about it, many foreign companies choose Gulf States as their Middle Eastern headquarters because of the low tax environment, but also because of the access to very abundant cheap labour, a lot of it coming from South Asia. You start to put more regulations on the foreign companies and operators in the country. Those companies quickly shift somewhere else, I think. But I think it's something that has to be done extremely gently and cautiously. Hans's comment about liberal arts education, I must try and defend liberal arts education. I think some of the best graduates are history graduates, humanities, things like that.
Thank you.
The best people get the best jobs because companies recognise skills like ability to speak publicly, presentation, meet deadlines. These are not necessarily connected to what specific thing you focused on between ages 18 and 22, but a set of lifelong knowledge economy skills you can learn as part of a liberal arts education. What I do think is the problem is what I mentioned before, that some of the focus in the liberal arts education in the Gulf has been very Western-centric. All of these world civilization classes, American history, etc. Where is the Gulf history? Where is the Gulf politics? Gulf literature, Arabic literature, it seems to be lacking at the moment.
Thank you. Please go.
What a great set of questions. With respect to the transnational corporations, I agree with Christian that what Abu Dhabi is doing is actually quite exciting in terms of the approach of taking a major equity stake in a big global transnational corporation that can bring its technology to the Gulf, and then it's investing in both the new sites here and the new base here, but also in the home base of where that. So, for example, Global Foundries has a factory in Singapore, and it has one in Dresden in Germany. So the money that Mubadala has invested in that is in not just in Abu Dhabi, but it's in those home-based locations. And I've talked to the people from Global Foundries about what they wish to do in terms of a science technology research center in Abu Dhabi, and they want to employ 5,000 scientists and engineers in Abu Dhabi itself. Now, in a way, that's pie in the sky, but if that's their vision, there's a chance that something like that may happen eventually. I think on the question of the labour cost issue and the sort of regulations around the labour market, I think there's an opportunity for all of us who've now been here in the Gulf for several years, who've come from a Western perspective, to actually relook at this whole issue of the role of the price mechanism, generally speaking, or the lack of the role of the price mechanism in a whole range of markets in the Gulf, and to try and come up with a totally radical new way of looking at some of these rigidities that exist at the moment, which are actually inimical to the development of a knowledge-based society amongst the indigenous people that live here. I'm not saying I have the answers, I'm just saying that I think I know what the questions are now. It's taken me about 7 years to get there. Which reminds me of the very first research project I did for the government in the UAE, which was exactly a question on the link between the labour market and the education system. And I delivered a 380-page report, which they then paid two consultants four times the money that they paid me to actually read it for them, to reduce it to 20 pages of bullet points. There's a lesson there in doing research and the role of research. About the education system itself and, you know, what's likely to work, I think you rule everything in. It's a question of, there's so many experiments going on in the Gulf. It's just a question of, as long as we don't actually damage anyone or harm them in the for the future, let's see what works best.
Thank you. Thank you for our speakers, Mr. Christian Artsen and Mr. Christopher Davidson and Mr. Kenneth Wilson, and thank you for I urge you to attend the next session.